Vice Marshal Johnson Reel 3.
Which was scandalous, really, because we could have escorted them to their drop-in positions, we could have known what the positions were, and so on and so forth, and perhaps done something about it on the following days. But we weren't consulted, although I understand that the senior officers of the 2nd Tactical Air Force did know about the drop and had objected to it during its planning stages because they considered it was too far and too hazardous. But this was Montgomery's master plan to end the war at a stroke, which proved him to be quite wrong.
You mentioned the German Ardennes offensive. Were you personally operating against that?
Yes, we were, and that, as I remember, was in the... was it in the January of 1945, was it?
And December 44.
December 44 and 45. And in the middle of it, we had the big blow, didn't we, when they shot up all our airfields. And they shot up mine at Brussels Auvergne and destroyed quite a lot of airplanes.
Can you describe that attack?
I can describe the attack because I was on the airfield at about 7 or 7.30 on that morning, New Year's morning, and my runway was frozen over, and it had thawed and then frozen. It was only a little runway. And I was trying to get some salt organised so we'd get a couple of airplanes off to do a weather reconnaissance over the front line. And actually I got two airplanes off. And then I got a squadron taxiing out when they came over without any warning at all. About a mixed bunch of 50 or 60 109s and 190s who proceeded at leisure, really, to destroy the squadron on the ground, who were all bunched up on the Peritirac and at the end of the runway. And two succeeded in getting off, the squadron commander and one other, who were immediately shot down before their wheels were up. So as far as we're concerned, it was rather a disaster. And they remained over the place for about 10 minutes. And meanwhile, the reconnaissance airplanes came back. The controller would recall them, and they shot down, I think, two or three airplanes. But from my point of view, it was quite disastrous.
Were there any casualties?
There were three or four pilots killed, yes, and a few ground troops and quite a lot of airplanes.
So you took shelter in slip trenches, did you?
I was outside my caravan. I didn't go in a slip trench because I was so bloody angry. Hopping up and down. Nothing I could do about it, really. We had no guns to defend us.
Do you think anything could have been done to have taken precautions against that?
We were, I suppose, New Year's Eve. I suppose it was... typical that the British were going to enjoy themselves, the war almost over. Psychologically, it was a very good blow, wasn't it? As it turned out, we were all there at dawn, ready to take off and so on, and we couldn't get off because of the frozen runway. I think our intelligence was very bad. I think that Galland, who'd assembled all these airplanes, including some from the Russian front and some from down from Norway and Denmark and that sort of thing, surely the intelligence, or Ultra, from what we're told. I mean, even Ultra in 1942 told Montgomery in the desert when Rommel was going to attack and when he wasn't going to attack, and I would have thought that we should have had some prior notice of that attack. It was very much written down by the commander-in-chief, Cunningham himself came round and that sort of thing, gave instructions that only the airplanes which were actually burnt out were to be reported as destroyed, none others, no, those that were merely damaged or undercarriage collapsed and all could be repaired were to be reported as damaged, just those which were actually on fire. So it was all played down very much and by our side, but it was a good blow by the Luftwaffe, really.
How soon afterwards were you able to take revenge, as it were?
Well, replacement airplanes were in the next day. So, I mean, that was the measure of our backup, wasn't it, really? Replacement airplanes and replacement pilots were the three or four pilots I'd lost. And that was true, I mean, at places like Eindhoven, and they'd lost 40 and 50 airplanes. And but they were all replaced within a matter of hours and so on and so forth. It was a good psychological blow, too late in the war to achieve anything, really.
Whilst you were in Belgium, did you see much of the conditions of the civilians there?
Yes, Fermi, yes. I remember going to dine with quite a well-to-do family in 1944, just after we arrived there, and we had a very good steak, which my host informed me afterwards was horse. The Belgians eat a lot of horse, apparently, even now. But I've never been very partial to it. So the Belgians were, I don't think they were as hard-pressed as the Dutch. I mean, Brussels was a glitter. There was champagne, there was all sorts of food if you could pay for it, and that sort of thing. Whereas Antwerp, when you got there, was a city of darkness and of no luxuries.
Did you get a welcome from the Belgians or not?
Yes, more of a welcome from the Belgians than the French, strangely enough.
Were the French hostile?
No, they weren't hostile, but they made sure you paid for everything. And the Belgians, there was a lot of goodies and entertaining and more spontaneous. So, you know, that was my impression at the time. The French were more cynical than the Belgians. There was certainly the welcome in Belgium far outweighed that in Paris.
Did you move up to a different airfield after this one at Brussels?
Auvers. Yes, we then went up to a place called Petit Brogel, B-R-O-G-E-L, for the Rhine crossing in 1944. That'd be 1945, wasn't it, really?
Yes.
And I still had the Canadian wing, 127 wing it was called at that time, 127 wing. And we took part in the Rhine crossing, which was where we had complete air superiority. I never saw a German airplane in the sky, although I did see some Dakotas shot down by flak. And then the next day I was promoted to group captain, went and took over my own 125 wing that was based at Eindhoven, and had those for the few short weeks the war lasted, until that was May. So I commanded those through May across the Rhine and into Germany, where we finished up at a place called Celle in early May on Spitfire 14s.
Did you see any of the German jets at the end of the war?
Yes, I saw them. I saw one well before the end of the war. I saw one over Arnhem one day towards the withdrawal. And when I saw it, I was leading a squadron and that sort of thing. This thing came in front of me and just disappeared out of sight and did a sort of slow roll. And this, there was nothing I could do about it. I didn't even have time to sort of pull the bloody nose up and fire at him. He was so fast and it disappeared. So they were far superior to anything we'd got. But they didn't have enough of them, thanks, as you may say, to the bombing, or Hitler, or East Gallant had the fight with him whether they should be bombers or fighters. Hitler wanted them as the reprisal bomber. They were a year too late in production, then. If they'd been a year earlier, and they'd had several hundred, then the Normandy invasion may have been different.
Did you realise that it didn't have a propeller? Did you realise how it was propelled?
Yes, because we had a bloody squadron at the same time, which was in my wing, eventually. And it was at Brussels when I was down there, of Spitfire 1s, and they weren't as fast as our Spitfire. That was the Meteor 1, that was our first jet. and they weren't as fast as our Spitfires. So the German 262 was infinitely superior to the Meteor 1, which was only put out there for propaganda purposes.
When you were in Germany, did you see anything of the devastation of the German towns by the British and American bombers?
Yes. I went and had a look at Hamburg. I went and had a look at Lübeck. Hanover, Cologne. The remarkable thing that all the churches and cathedrals in Maine, and I don't suppose that's anything to do with Jesus Christ, just happened because they were so marvellously built. Wasn't it in those days, you know, stone walls 12 feet thick and beautiful arches and so on and so forth. And it was quite extraordinary to see how Hamburg, which was devastated, the firestorms, bomber command night after night and so on and so forth, and the 8th Air Force, and yet within 6 months that there was some semblance of life there. You know, the streets were being cleared, orchestras were playing, hotels were beginning to open and so on, showing the resistance of the human spirit, if you like, or the German people, I don't know. But, I mean, that city soon began to come alive again, despite the devastation, where you thought, you know, immediately the war ended, you couldn't pick your way through the bloody place.
What was the attitude of the Germans toward you?
The attitude of the Germans towards us was rather admiring, I thought. I mean, the most people, I finished up to the place called Lübeck. We went up to Copenhagen, then came to receive the adulation of the Danes, and we came back from Copenhagen to a place called Lübeck, where I had a lot of Germans who surrendered, and they were working force in some sort of a labour force, and they had their own mess and that sort of thing, and they were rather... it was almost an admiration for us, really, that we'd beaten the shit out of them, so we were a bit better than them, and they admired us, really.
Was that an admiration for the British or for the Royal Air Force?
Oh, no, I think for the British generally. And so on and so forth. They were told me many times they were pleased they were working for me and not the Russians, who were about 5 miles away across the border. there was no civility or anything like that. They thought that they had fought a fair war against us and lost and so on and so forth, and therefore we should treat them with the respect they deserved and so on.
What about this so-called no fraternization order?
Well, that was stupid, wasn't it? It was Montgomery's bloody stupid order. I mean, he was more of a monk than a man. I mean, fraternization with a million chaps, they're all rushing around with cocks hanging out and so on and so forth. They're going to fraternise with everything. I mean, and I remember one of my corporals from the accounts office, and he came up to me in Lübeck after 6 months, and he said, "I'm going now, would you keep an eye on my girlfriend till I want to get discharged from the Air Force, come back and marry her?" And he said, "I've told her to come and see you if she's in trouble." And I said, "Okay, I'll try and do that for you." He said, "I bought her a couple of houses down the road." He'd actually bought a couple of houses and gone through the legal. I'd got the money through flogging cigarettes and so on and so forth, and bought a couple of houses and given her the deeds. That's good. That's enterprise, isn't it?
It is. Did you have to go to Asia to fight against the Japanese?
No. I went to Korea in 1950, later on, but that was a vastly different war altogether, because the Americans wanted, as in Vietnam, wanted little part of it, really. And, I was continually stopped when I was in Korea in 1950 by Americans who say, "You know what the hell are we doing here?" and so on and so forth, all these little yellow fellows and so on.
Did you have flying duties in Korea?
Yes, I did.
What were you flying there?
Well, I was sent out. I was out in the States as an exchange officer, and I was sent to Korea by the chief of the air staff, a fellow called Jack Slessor, to report on tactical aviation in Korea. So what did I fly out in Korea? 80s, F-80s, F-86s, the Sabres, and a bomber called a B-26. That was really in the end of 1950, beginning of 1951, before the appearance of the MiG in numbers, so I didn't have any combats against the MiG or anything like that. My main reaction was the adverse remarks of the American army, who didn't want to be there and didn't want to fight them anyway, just like Vietnam.
What did you think of flying jets as after propeller-driven aircraft?
Quieter, better view, and less fatiguing. Didn't have this drone, which in your rear the whole time, which drove us all deaf, I suppose, or partially deaf.
What was the gist of your report to Slessor?
The gist of my report to Slessor was that tactical aviation had saved the day.
Why was that?
Because as the North Koreans advanced down to the perimeter at Pusan, right down in the south of country, and the army formed a defensive perimeter around it, and it was the Air Force that held the army off the backs of the American army by fighter bombing and medium bombers and strafing and so on and so forth all through the daylight and at night. And General Walker, who was commanding the American army, admitted the Air Force saved the day.
Did you ever use napalm in Korea?
Yes.
How was that done? How was it carried and so on?
It was carried in long-range tanks underneath the wings, and you really let it drop when the target, you flew at low level, and you let it drop when the target disappeared under your nose. If you were going to a tank there and so on and so forth, and you were flying really low at sort of 50 feet, as soon as the tank disappeared under your nose, you pulled the press the tip, and the napalm tanks dropped, and they ignited when they struck and so on and so forth, and it was rather like throwing a bucket of water over a bit of paved area.
What did you think to it as a weapon?
I thought it was very good. Humanity excluded, but as a weapon, it was very good because it fried people up and it went into slit trenches and burnt them and so on and so forth. And we adopted it as quickly as we could, despite what we say about it now or what the United Nations say about it. We, the British, made napalm and adopted it.
So you didn't have any qualms about using it?
I think when you're fighting a war, you don't really, do you?
What was the enemy flak like in Korea as compared with the Second World War?
Nothing like the Ruhr. Nothing like the Ruhr, no. Very, very sparse, very sparse. But up in Vietnam, over Hanoi, I'm told that in 1972 you could walk on it.
I think you've got some opinions about where the second front was launched in Normandy.
Well, you see, yes, I have, and Normandy was chosen because the Pas-de-Calais, as everybody sort of said, was the obvious place. But we could have given much better air cover over the Pas-de-Calais, just those 20 miles across the channel, than we could at Normandy, which was 80 miles across the channel. And also, one of the great difficulties in Normandy was that we couldn't find the Tiger tanks and the enemy guns because of the bocage country, because they were dug in the hedgerows, like the Devon hedgerows, and cleared. And it wasn't until Saint Lô in August the 17th, when the enemy moved his tanks out into the open, that we were able to get at them. Whereas if we'd gone into the Pas-de-Calais, the air cover and air support would have been far better and greater than we provided in Normandy. And all the German generals have always said from the desert onwards that it was the tactical air that defeated them, because they couldn't move and the communications had gone and so on and so forth. And tactical air would have been far more devastating in the Pas-de-Calais than Normandy.
But presumably the Germans would have been more prepared in the Pas-de-Calais.
I think they would have been more prepared, but we had such a preponderance in the air, didn't we, with all these thousands of the 9th Air Force and Bomber Command and 8th Air Force and 2nd TAF, we'd have bloody swamped them.
You get the impression about flying over Normandy that there was a real danger of collision because of the number of Allied aircraft.
There was.
Did you actually see any collisions?
No, I didn't see any collisions, but there were. And we were all on the lookout for friendly airplanes and not enemy. I mean, 9,000 tactical airplanes in one part of the sky. It's a lot of airplanes, isn't it?
It is indeed.
And I'm very much amused these days when I read in a paper that some pilot's reported a near miss because he's seen somebody a mile away.